with Hurley, Turley, I mean, William Turley, he argued that the points I mentioned on the last tape all add up to the or an explanation of why the VC has been defeated and the North Vietnamese army has been brought to a standstill. His key argument is that the strategy, political and social strategy included, and the tactics designed for a peasant population, a peasant society, the guerrilla warfare procedures that the North Vietnamese developed on the basis of Mao Zedong's theory, that these strategies and these tactics have failed because the character of the South Vietnamese society has been transformed. It's no longer predominantly a peasant society. It's an urban society. And the people in the cities have a lot to lose. Most of them. And the guerrillas can't operate in the cities successfully as they used to in the countryside. This idea, this explanation, I think is very important and very keen. It makes an amazing picture. It's as if the American South, in the course of our Civil War, if that Civil War had lasted long enough, as if the American South had been transformed in the course of the war from a backward slave plantation society into a more modern, middle-class, capitalistic, business-minded society. Just to pursue the analogy a bit farther, it's as if the South had really obtained the help from Britain that it worked for so hard and in vain, and that the help from Britain had transformed the South into a mini replica of British industrialized, modernized society. In a case like that, it wouldn't be expected that the South could be overcome as it was by the Northern armies. Now Turley says that the problem of South Vietnam is to go on and develop not merely an urbanized society living largely on foreign help, but an indigenous industrialized society. This is beginning, and one can see some beginnings of it outside Saigon, but it has a long distance to go. However, the example of Korea, South Korea, is there. Korea is industrializing very fast. And one imagines that with the kind of help that South Korea obtained during and after the war, South Vietnam can match the performance of the Koreans. It's also true that South Vietnam has one of the largest armies and air forces in the world. And when the manpower and capital and energy that are expended on these are released for civilian activity, then the possibility becomes quite meaningful. Now, the particular importance of all this to me is that the writers we've been reading in the United States, both in the press and in books, are just not up to date. They have not told us about the new developments of the last few years. I have got information about these developments from a number of people, both Americans and Vietnamese, and some of these developments are clear to the eye as one goes about. Another point may be that the changes in South Vietnamese society provide a stronger foundation for Vietnamization than we have imagined or heard about at home. With respect to the scandalous slums developing around the big cities, which one reads about at home, Turley agrees with my very modest observation that this doesn't really amount to very much. Probably crowding, of course, but no great belts of new slum shack construction around the cities, as we've been told. There were two major displacements of population, according to Turley. One in, or three really, one in 65, one at the time of Tet, and one beginning last spring. In other words, the major BC and North Vietnamese offensives have produced these great displacements. Our side, of course, doing its share of damage to villages and producing its share of refugees in that sense, but in response to offensives from the other side. He told me about one refugee camp near Da Nang that has 300,000 people in it. He agreed with what I heard at the smaller camp I saw, that these people are simply waiting to go home and ready to go home the moment they can. Some have gone home already in places where the North Vietnamese have been pushed back. One wonders whether there won't be some restoration of peasant life if and when there's a stop to the fighting, as these vast numbers of refugees return to their villages and the land. But Turley was full of stories to the effect that the South Vietnamese, like people most everywhere in the world, like city life. They like it better than rural life. And having a taste of it, they want to stick to it. Turley's main job here is interviewing Chua Hoi at the very camp for defectors or returnees in official jargon that Bill Henderson and I visited. And through his interviews with the Chua Hoi, he is trying to get at the character of North Vietnamese communism, trying to put together a picture. He's received his doctorate for work of this sort. He wants now to develop a book. He told me, by the way, that the Phoenix program, which began as an American program some years ago, has been turned over to the South Vietnamese. The Phoenix program, which one gets such mysterious hints about at home, he says it was simply and is simply an outright counter-terrorist program against the VC and North Vietnamese. Later, I walked farther into the more unsavory districts of Saigon than I had done. In the middle of a quite ratty but very wide street, I found hidden the USO. Well, it was just about empty. I suppose it was important when there were a great many American soldiers here and before this street, like so many, deteriorated with sidewalk markets and dirt and an end to the flower markets and so forth. One hears nostalgic stories about what these main boulevards were like in the old days. Well, I made my way to what's really the best small French restaurant that I found, Le Cave. Made my way through street markets and pedestrians and roaring Hondas and billows of gasoline smoke, frightful noise, terrible as bad a walk in a city as I have ever had. And this is the usual thing in Saigon. Well, at Le Cave, I had a very quiet and very good dinner. Coming out, I made the mistake of taking a trishaw. And sure enough, the fellow who was peddling behind me behaved exactly like the trishaw peddlers in Phnom Penh some years ago. He was a peddler as well as a peddler. He wanted to peddle girls. When I said no, he said, "What about his little sister? She number one fuck, she number one virgin." I said, "No." He said, "What you like? You like boys?" I said, "No." He said, "What you like, fuck?" And I used the same dodge that worked so well in Phnom Penh. I said, "Goats." And this quieted him for a bit. But then he came up with a new one. He said, "You like see me fuck?" I said no, but this didn't stop him. He said, "I fuck girl, nice girl, you watch, you look." And when I said no, he said, "I fuck two girl, nice girl." And I said no. And he seemed to be at a loss and said, "What you like?" And I said, "Fuck 10 girls." Well, he thought this was a hilarious joke and he gave up.
Shut up.
After that. On Trudeau, the main street from the Roman Catholic Cathedral to the river, The girls are apparently forbidden to solicit on the street, although once or twice close to curfew, I've seen them dart out. Normally, as you pass by quite a number of storefronts, sometimes looking like restaurant fronts, are occupied by a little bevy of eager, anxious-looking, overpainted girls who have a more than business-like way of banging on the window and saying, "Come here, honey." The terrace of the Continental Palace Hotel is raided by the police regularly, but they apparently let the girls go just as regularly. And the solicitations there on the terrace of the few American soldiers who are around go on very busily. But the situation doesn't begin to compare with that of 42nd Street and 8th Avenue in New York. A Puritanism that maybe a leftover from the days of Madame New, who forbade all dancing and so on. A Puritanism prevails. This is particularly true in matters of publications, books, magazines. The bookshelves look like the days before the Ulysses decision in the United States. This is Saturday afternoon, January 20. This morning I had a two-hour interview with Professor Nguyen Ngoc Huy, H-U-Y. He's the Secretary General of the Nationalist Progressive Party, or as they translate it, Progressist Party. He seems young for such responsibility, but he remembers events very well, back at least as far as 1944. I asked him my standard question: what does he think is the reason for the failure of the United States in South Vietnam? And he answered with a rather original idea. He said the United States collaborated only with the governments of the Republic, whatever government was in power, instead of collaborating with private groups, social groups. He didn't mention political parties. He said the Vietnamese governments, particularly of Diem early on and the present government of Thieu, were not good. He said they exploited United States aid. In the course of discussion, I mentioned as tactfully as I could that, to my knowledge, no government allied with another country has ever ignored its government and collaborated with private groups instead of the government. And he admitted that this presented and presents what he called a dilemma. We would be accused of intervening in the domestic affairs of South Vietnam. On the other hand, by working with the governments in power, we have been frustrated by the abuse of United States aid by those governments. Now, he has apparently thought about this quite a good deal. He said that the traditional way
of working with an allied government works where there is a government, but it doesn't work, he says, in new countries where the government is not as yet effective. He said the people of South Vietnam think the United States can do anything. They think the United States can control the government of the Republic, President Thieu, even though this is not true. They think the United States overthrew President Diem. The people blame the United States for bad Vietnamese policies. He said the United States should have worked with social welfare groups, as he called them, private ones, instead of working with the governments. Well, I just can't picture it. He admitted to me that his national progressive movement doesn't organize followers among the people, that it's really a grouping of leaders without a mass base. He said the reason for this is that under French rule, the people were not allowed to organize, that this was also true under Bao Dai, also true under Diem. And after 1965, under the present regime, some liberty has been allowed. But he explained very carefully that young men and women under 18 do not take part in politics. And from 18 to 43, the men are subject to military duty. And this leaves old men and women to take part in politics. He said that there are some women in his party. He said it's the largest non-governmental party. Soldiers in the army are forbidden to take part in political party activity. He said also there is the factor of money. His party and others lack funds. They have only the contributions of their members. He was very strong on the point that President Diem created fear and hatred of parties. His own movement has 20 members in the assembly, the lower house of the legislature. I asked him what the program of his party was, and he said it's nationalism, socialism, and democracy. In discussing this, it came out that by socialism, he doesn't at all mean nationalization of industries. He means social reform. He spoke of the Labour Party of Great Britain, the party of Willy Brandt in West Germany, and the Democratic Party in the United States. Let private enterprise operate, but tax it and use the money to improve the life of the poor. That's his idea of socialism. He said their party newspaper has a circulation of 10,000, that is a sale of 10,000, and a much larger circulation because he says it's customary for Vietnamese to pass newspapers around. 10,000, he said, was a very good average. His party holds monthly meetings in places where it can, and an annual congress. It's been growing until this year. But he says that now there is pressure by the Thieu administration for members to leave his party, to abandon his party. He says that the administration puts pressure on members of his party who are who hold office as councillors in villages, and they are forbidden to take part in non-governmental political activities, and if they don't come to heel, they're drafted. So he said it's very difficult to organize voters in these circumstances. He said that the main strength of his party was in the cities earlier, but that organizers have moved out into the provinces. We turn to questions of United States policy. He said that what the United States did in 1964-5 in beginning the major escalation under President Johnson was very necessary and the right thing to do, but he said that it was not done in the right way. He said that Nixon's way is better. Johnson escalated slowly and gradually, and the other side was able to match this escalation. Nixon's way of hitting suddenly and hitting hard, he believes, would have worked better back in 65 and might have brought victory. He said that in 1964-5 and on, the following years, there is a situation that was really a vicious circle. The peasants were made to fear communism by the behavior of the VC and the North Vietnamese Army, but on the other hand, they were afraid to resist. And the terrorism of the communists was working. So the more resistance, the more terrorism. This was the vicious circle, I gather. United States intervention was very necessary and did accomplish one thing, he said. It gave Vietnam time to organize an army here in the South. He also believes that Johnson should have invaded North Vietnam, at least one province, in order to have something to exchange for the areas that the North controls in the South. Now, he says, the Republic here has nothing to exchange. About the United States pacification programs, he says they were good in principle. They were carried out in a very poor way. And the reason for this chiefly, he declared, was corruption among Vietnamese officials and the use of corrupt people. He says communist rule was like that of some ancient ruler whose name I didn't catch, who ruled with two hands. With the right hand, he repressed his people. With the left hand, he held out rewards to them. He says that communist terror and communist promises work this way. And he also said that United States bombing in free fire zones, causing a great deal of fear, causing actually more fear than communist terrorism, worked and was effective. And he says this is the basic reason, the fear that was created by American bombing. This is the basic reason why people left the villages. And so, in referring to the ideas which Turley had been expressing to me, Professor Hui declared that the water in Mao Zedong's metaphor, has been removed from the fish, the gorillas, and that's why the gorillas are failing. The central point is
that
American bombing was more effective than communist
terrorism.
He's saying, in effect, that a vast dislocation of society, conversion of a peasant society into an urban society, creation of vast numbers of refugees, not to mention civilians who were killed and wounded, that all of this was the only effective way to counteract communist control of the villages through terrorism. He believes in the American policy. He thinks it was good. He thinks it was the only thing that could be done. He thinks it had to be done. He's glad that it was done. The rewards side of American policy apparently consists in the vast quantities of money in the form of